Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. This week, were the 1975 right to speak out in Malaysia? Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Kirk. Hello, Chris.
I'm not sure I recognise that pronunciation of my name, but hello there.
It's got two O's in it. It's got to be Kirk.
I'm not quite sure why you're bringing this up after so many years of doing that introduction, but whatever makes you happy, I guess.
Yeah. As ever, we're going to take a look back at some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last week. A week when the Mercury Prize shortlist was announced.
It was indeed. And I know this for a fact. In fact, I think this is probably a scientifically proven fact that ever since this year's Mercury Prize shortlist was announced last week, everybody has been thinking, what does CMU's Andy Malt think about this year's shortlisted albums? That's the question that I've heard. Well, I mean, I've not heard it. I've not seen anyone say it or write it or put it on social media, but I know I've sensed it. I've sensed that that is the question.
I don't know that I've even thought that.
So. Well, tell you what, let's both think it right now. I have the shortlist in front of me. It's in alphabetical order. So that's a good
best
start.
Way.
And let's get, I think we've done this before on Setlist, not with this year's shortlist, obviously, but with past year's shortlist. Let's get your 1, 2, maybe we'll allow you up to 3-word opinions about each of this year's shortlisted albums. As, you know, the music expert Andy Malt is. Is that okay?
Yeah, fine.
Okay, so from the top, A through Z, first of all, the Arctic Monkeys nominated for the 5th fucking time for this bloody award.
Calm down.
For the best album of the last year from the UK or Ireland. That's the official blurb, isn't it? 5th nomination. I mean, I think personally, once you've had 3 nominations should be the limit. I don't see it. Once you've had 3 nominations, I don't see the point in having a 5th. Although they've only won it once, haven't they? So actually, they have failed more than they succeeded. This is for their album, The Car. 1, 2, or 3 words on that album.
Not really interested.
Did you see them play Glastonbury?
Nope. Heard that it was quite bad, though.
Well, opinions were divided, I thought, but boring was one word I was hearing used by some people. Some people seem to like it. Anyway, clearly the Mercury Prize shortlists are still Arctic Monkeys fans, so that's one thing. Ezra Collective, Where I'm Meant to Be.
That's a good album. I've got that on vinyl. It's good. That's they're the jazz act.
Yes.
And they're a good one. I wouldn't mind if they won it.
That could be their sticker. They're the jazz act, and they're good. That could go on the album, couldn't it? Do they still put stickers on albums for the Mercury? I mean, do they still have albums to put stickers on? They clearly have a vinyl version because you bought it. Number 3, we're into the Fs. Fred again with a ridiculously long-titled album, Actual Life 3, open brackets, January 1 to September 9, 2022, close brackets.
Yeah. I've really warmed to Fred again recently. I kind of didn't have a lot of time for him, but actually, I think he's really good.
Good.
I did see him at I saw him at Glastonbury. He was sort of within view from my tent where I was sitting, and it was good. Yeah, good stuff. I haven't listened to that album, but yeah.
Did he give a performance worthy of a Mercury Prize winning artist?
Well, I don't think it's taken into consideration. So, no, it doesn't matter how good they are live. That's not what this award's about.
Yeah, but what is this award about? Still don't really know, do we? Next, J Huss, A Beautiful and Brutal Yard, 2nd nomination, also nominated back in 2017. Opinions?
I thought he'd won it in 2017. I think maybe he was the favourite and then didn't win it. I'd have to go back and see who did. Bit of a comeback album for him, I think. As you might hear several times in the next couple of minutes, I've not listened to this album. So, but it's, you know, it's been well reviewed. People like it. It's got on this list.
Thank you for that vital insight on that Mercury nominated album there. Jesse Ware next, also second nomination, but more than 10 years since her last nomination, nominated for That Feels Good.
Yeah, nominated in 2012, and now she's back again. And this album has some good songs on it. I quite like Jessie Ware. She's fun. I don't know that it's a winning album.
Another quote for the sticker there. If they don't put stickers on the CDs anymore, they should bring it back just so that they can put on the Jessie Ware Mercury-nominated album some good songs on this. Jockstrap, I love you, Jennifer B.
Everyone's very excited about Jockstrap. Everyone. And I went to see Jockstrap to see what the fuss was about, and I did not understand it in the slightest, as I find it all very confusing and it makes me feel old, so I don't want it to win.
Well, let's send the memo round to the Mercury Prize judging panel to ensure that they don't win. Young Fathers are going to win, aren't they? So I don't think you need to worry about that. Let's not get to Young Fathers yet. We're doing this A to Z, remember. Next is Lancome with False Lancome.
Irish folk group. I had never heard of them until about 10 minutes ago, because I didn't even notice their name on the shortlist when I read it yesterday. So good stuff. I'm sure they're great.
Definitely. Loyal Kana, Hugo, another repeat nomination. A lot of repeat nominations this year.
Yeah, and surely. And surely he's got to be one of the favourites. That's a really good album. I really like that album. Yeah. I would put that up there in the running for being the winner.
We found one you like. It only took us L, but we got there. Olivia Dean Messi.
She's a singer. She's worked with Rudimental. Who's next?
Thanks for that. Ray, my 21st Century Blues.
Oh, now this is an interesting one, isn't it? Because there's a big story, isn't it? Because Ray obviously fell out with her former record label, Polydor, and managed to get released because she said Polydor had refused to let her release an album despite her being signed to them for years. And then she managed to get herself released from her record contract. She self-released her album, this album, and it did really well. So Polydor should have tried harder.
They should. It would be quite funny if this one, given that means...
This could have been a Polydor potential win, and now it's an independent potential win.
So fingers crossed, that would be funny. Last time I went to the Mercury Prize, which is quite a long time ago now, as I'm going to tell you in a moment, I think I went at Universal Music's invitation. I think I was on the Universal table. It's back when Universal Music used to talk to me. That's how long ago it was. Weirdly, it was in the days when we used to slag them off a lot more. We stopped slagging them off so much and now they don't talk to me. But I would quite like to go this year and be on Universal's table and Ray win, because that would be quite amusing.
Stop trying to blag your way into things. You're not going. I forbid it. Well,
I think we can all agree that if there was a Mercury Prize to go to, it was last year's round one, because that was definitely an experience to remember, because the Queen died, as you may remember, and the whole thing got cancelled just as they were about to eat their food. But we're nearly done on this. We're not going to spend the entire set list on this. In a moment, I'm going to say this is not what we're here to talk about this week. It's quite ironic how much we've talked about it. Shy Girl Nymph is the penultimate album on this shortlist.
It is, yeah. Shy Girl is good. She's been around for a while, but I think this is her debut album. I'm pretty sure I'm right in saying that. And I don't know if it's a winner. I feel bad saying that because it could be, but it's up against quite a lot of strong contenders. It would be nice because she's a bit less well known than a lot of the others, but yeah, I think someone else is going to take it. I think it's Loyal Kana or Ray. That's what I'm going with.
I think Young Fathers could be second win. They last won in 2014, which is the last year I went to the Mercury Prize. That's how long it's been since I've been invited. They are nominated once again with Heavy Heavy.
Yeah, that's a good album. So, yeah, it could be a second win for them. I'd suspect it won't be, but it could be. Definitely could be.
The one thing I remember about the 2014 Mercury Prize, the last time I went, well, the main thing I remember is that they didn't serve fish, which is relevant for reasons I won't go into.
Oh, let's not get into that.
There's probably a previous podcast where we've talked about that.
But, oh, there is.
One thing I do remember is, I don't know if they still do this with the Mercury Prize, but it used to be that all the acts would perform, then you would eat, and while you were eating, the judging panel would pick a winner, and then they would announce the winner, which, I mean, is a format, except that that meant that you didn't start eating till about 9 o'clock, by which point you were very hungry, and so therefore you were watching the performances very hungry, and I just remember getting quite bored with the performances, except Young Fathers, which really stood out, and it was hard not to think, wow, that was a very strong performance, and then they won, and that was nice. But anyway, that is the Mercury Prize shortlist.
But presumably also, if people weren't eating till 9, everyone was very drunk by the time.
Not me. So the point is, no one else can remember that the Young Fathers were very good, because at that point they were very, very, very drunk, whereas I'm the person who remembers no fish. Young Fathers were good. There you go. That's my summary of the 2014 Mercury Prize, which we're now talking about on this edition of Setlist.
Great memories.
But let's be clear, whether we're talking about 2014, whether we're talking about 2023, whether we're talking about the time the Queen died, we are not here to talk about the Mercury Prize, anything to do with the Mercury Prize. We're not even here to talk about Mercury Communications or Freddie Mercury or the defunct Universal subsidiary label Sister to Polydor Mercury or the planet Mercury. There will be no Mercuries on this edition of Setlist because it is not what we're here to talk about.
No, it's not. Later on, we will be discussing the latest developments with the Leadmill Music Venue in Sheffield. But first, there has been a huge amount of debate over the last week about comments made by the 1975's frontman Matty Healy on stage at a festival in Malaysia, where he criticised the country's anti-LGBTQ plus laws, which resulted in not only the band's set being cut short, but the entire rest of the festival being cancelled and the 1975 being banned from Malaysia, put on a plane home later that night. So this all took place the weekend before last, on the Friday night of the Good Vibes Festival in Kuala Lumpur, and the 1975 were headlining, and a few songs into their set, Healy spoke to the audience and said, "I made a mistake. When we were booking shows, I wasn't looking into it. I don't see the fucking point, right? I do not see the point of inviting the 1975 to a country and then telling us who we can have sex with." He then kissed bassist Ross McDonald on the mouth and added, "I'm sorry if that offends you and you're religious and it's part of your fucking government, but your government are a bunch of fucking retards. I don't care anymore. If you push, I'm going to push back. I am not in the fucking mood. I am not in the fucking mood." That's what he said. And then, yeah, the festival organisers pretty immediately cut the band off, got them off stage. The government then forced the rest of the festival to be cancelled, so 2 full days of the festival to be cancelled. And in the middle of the night, the 1975 were packed onto a plane and sent the hell out of Malaysia. Now, the debate surrounding this is whether or not what Matty Healy did was a good thing or not. And while that might seem like a pretty black and white debate on the surface of it, it's not. So we're going to talk about it.
Yes. I mean, presumably in the country of Malaysia itself, there are people who think that what he said was good and people who think that what he said was bad based on their views towards the anti-LGBTQ plus laws that exist in Malaysia. But I think from our perspective, what's more interesting is the debate that's been going on, where there are people criticizing what he did who agree 100% with his stance and his sentiment. They would agree with him that the laws that he was criticizing are bad laws. They are wrong laws. They are laws that us in the West should be trying to put pressure on lawmakers in that country to get rid of. But the question is, was the way he did it, was the words he used, was the way he acted on stage. Was it a good move in terms of putting the spotlight on those issues in that country? Or actually, has he caused more harm than good? And as we say, there have been lots of debates. And amongst the people who think that what he said was right, there are critics who have been saying right sentiment, but the wrong way to deliver the message.
Yeah, one critic of how he went about it was the Malaysian drag queen Carmen Rose, who gave an interview to the BBC World Service and said, "I think there is a right place and time to do what he did and how you deliver the message that he delivered. It was very obvious that he was intoxicated and he wasn't in the right space to do that. I think the way he said what he said was very performative. It's giving off a sense of white saviour complex, which is something a lot of people accused him of. And he wasn't doing it for our community, because if he was, he would know what the consequences we would have to go through would be. I don't think he cares about us, just himself." And she went on, "Right now, the state elections are just around the corner and politicians are going to use this as a scapegoat, or it gives them more ammo to further their homophobic agenda." So that's a pretty strong statement against what Matt Healey did. And basically, yeah, saying he did it to make himself look good more than take a stand against something he disagreed with.
But as we say, there have been people speaking on both sides of this debate. So, for example, longtime LGBTQ plus rights campaigner Peter Tatchell wrote an interesting column in The Guardian in which he stated outright, "Matt Healey is not a white saviour for showing solidarity with Malaysian LGBTs. The Kuala Lumpur regime will be delighted that the focus is now on the 1975 rather than the LGBT plus human rights abuses the band were condemning." Whatever you think about Healey's actions, he then went on in his article, he succeeded in drawing global attention to Malaysia's persecution of its queer citizens, more so than any other action by anyone else. Hundreds of millions of people are now aware that Malaysia penalises LGBT plus people with up to 20 years jail plus canings and fines under a colonial era law that was originally imposed in the country by Britain in 1871.
Yeah, and although he hasn't really spoken very much about it, since Healey did respond to that article on Instagram saying, "Thank you, Peter. You have always been a hero of mine and a great friend to many people I love dearly. You mean a lot to so many people."
So two differing positions there from two different people who ultimately have the same view when it comes to the laws that Healey was condemning. They both believe those laws are wrong. They both believe those laws should be removed in Malaysia, but very different opinions on whether or not speaking out in the way that he did on stage was the right thing to do. Or, I mean, some people are saying actually maybe he set back some of the achievements from the LGBTQ plus community in Malaysia itself. And I don't know. I mean, I been reading quite a lot on this over the last week, and it's a topic I found fascinating, and not that I have any particular opinions one way or the other, because I'm not sure I have enough information or knowledge to have opinions one way or the other, but I am increasingly interested when it comes to people who are making statements like this, who are in the public eye, or people who stage stunts, or, you know, very sort of in-your-face campaigns around certain political issues, whether it is LGBTQ plus rights, or whether, you know, things like climate change and some of the other big talking points of the moment. I'm always interested to know, is that activism, are those statements, is it good? Bearing in mind, this is usually where I kind of agree with whatever it is the activist is saying or campaigning for. Is what they did a good way to bring wider attention to these issues and ultimately to bring about tangible change? Or can it be counterproductive? I'm always nervous because, you know, often people who you sense actually disagree with what the activist is doing will say, oh, it's counterproductive what they're doing, their tactics are wrong, etc., etc. So I'm always nervous of that. Having said that, I think that sometimes you can have a public figure saying something in the wrong way, in the wrong place, and actually doing more damage than good. I think that some activism sometimes doesn't help the cause or the people that the activist in theory is seeking to help. And I find that fascinating. And yeah, if anyone listening knows any books I should be reading on this topic, or preferably podcasts I could listen to, I would be really interested to know.
Yeah, and as this all obviously led to the cancellation of the entire rest of the festival, there's another debate over the effect his actions had on, I mean, a huge number of other people. So in its statement announcing the cancellation, the Good Vibes Festival's organisers said, this decision adheres to the immediate cancellation directive issued at 1:20 p.m. at the 22nd of July 2023 by the Ministry of Communications and Digital. The ministry has underlined its unwavering stance against any parties that challenge, ridicule or contravene Malaysian laws. We sincerely apologise to all of our ticket holders, vendors, sponsors and partners. We're aware of the time, energy and efforts you have put into making this festival a success, and we value your steadfast support. Alongside that, it was obviously the artists. There were other international artists who were set to play the festival. There were a lot of local artists set to play the festival. And there was a big question over whether particularly the local artists would actually get paid because they hadn't been able to perform and the festival had been cancelled. And obviously that's, you know, losing out on a big platform like this, it's a big festival. That's a big thing for the artists who were involved, who were set to play the last 2 days of this festival.
Yeah, and I guess, once again, even if you think that Matt Healy's criticisms of the anti-LGBTQ plus laws in Malaysia were correct, and even if you think that the government in that country, you know, completely overreacted, and the fact that, you know, they're able to cancel the festival, that is also wrong. In practical terms, lots of artists and people who had, you know, all the sort of the food stall people and people like that at the festival were negatively impacted by it. Yeah, and I think there is a distinction there between the international artists and the local artists, because according to local media reports, obviously it's annoying for the international artists who have traveled over there and are all getting ready to play. But generally how it works in that market with festivals is international artists are generally paid their complete fees up front, because obviously if you're going to fly halfway across the world, you need to be certain that you're going to get paid. Whereas a lot of the local artists would get some of their payment prior to the event, but they would get some of their payment after the event. And it's not yet clear whether or not that means, because the festival didn't go ahead, will they get those additional payments or will they not? And as a result of that, legal action has already begun. So there is a lawyer based in Malaysia who pretty much immediately, as soon as it had been confirmed that the government had forced the rest of the festival to cancel, he posted to LinkedIn and said, the Good Vibes Festival got cancelled. And I presume that local artists who were to perform today and tomorrow will not get their full pay because of this cancellation. I am happy to represent all the local artists pro bono to sue the band, the 1975, for causing loss. He then added a paragraph targeted specifically at Matt Healy and the band, in which he said, it is not the 1975's time or space to tell us how to run our country. You should have stuck to your scope of work as per your contract, which you recklessly breached. You are very silly. Regarding the band's contractual commitments, we've also been told that the band had specifically said that they would comply with local rules regarding performing in the country, which obviously includes not speaking out against laws and government policies in that country. Reports say that actually, initially, because the festival has to get permission for these international artists to play, that permission was originally denied. They then got commitments from the band that they would follow the rules. That was why they were allowed to play. And then the festival said, but Healy did not honour those assurances, so therefore probably the 1975 are in breach of their contract with the festival. That may also result in some sort of legal action, although that's still to be confirmed. The festival told the NME in their report on this that they were considering their options. Meanwhile, this other lawyer, Matthew Thomas Phillip, whose law firm is called Thomas Phillip, he has begun the process of getting local artists and vendors together to file a class action against the band in Malaysia.
Yeah, apparently around 70 people attended a meeting organised by Thomas Phillip last week, including artists, vendors and journalists. And the lawyer told the people at that meeting, my view is that the 1975 must be held responsible and accountable for the losses suffered by the artists and vendors. He then told the NME that 10 people were already on board for the class action lawsuit that he is now organising.
Yeah, so that's 5 artists and 5 vendors, we are told. So I guess while the debate around all of this, was it the right thing to do? Was it the wrong thing to do? That will almost certainly continue. And there's lots of different aspects and elements to that debate. Meanwhile, will this litigation actually result in a lawsuit being filed? And if so, how will that progress? Well, that's another side of this story that will continue, and we'll keep an eye on and see where it goes next.
And finally, on this edition of Setlist, the Save the Leadmill campaign moved up a gear last week, with the venue's existing management saying that their dispute with the landlord of the building, Electric Group, is a battle for the soul of Sheffield. This comes ahead of a Sheffield Council meeting set for September, where the Electric Group, which wants to directly run the venue itself, will seek its own licence from the local authority. And in a bid to rally further support ahead of that licensing meeting, the current management posted a very emotive video last week that made some pretty bold statements. It starts out saying, "This is a battle for the soul of Sheffield. It's a battle for everything that has made our city what it is today." Meanwhile, the boss of the Electric Group, Dominic Madden, has again hit out at the Save the Leadmill campaign, which he's previously called toxic. Last week, he accused the current Leadmill operator, Phil Mills, and his team of deliberately misleading the public into thinking that the venue will close when the Electric Group takes control of the building. But the Electric Group is a music venue business, and it does plan to run and program the Leadmill in a similar way to how it is being programmed and run at the moment.
So let's just maybe backtrack on this story and remind ourselves as how we got to where we are right now. So the Electric Group bought the building that houses the Leadmill in Sheffield back in 2016. And I think the plan all along was that ultimately the Electric Group, as a company that runs venues in London and Bristol and more recently opened a venue in Newcastle, the plan all along was that ultimately they would take direct control of running that venue rather than having the current team who are programming and running the space being in charge. But that was properly confirmed last year when in March the current management team were basically given 12 months notice that their lease was expiring, it would not be renewed, and at the end of that 12 month period the Electric Group would come in and start directly managing the space. However, the current management team are very eager to remain in place, and therefore they pretty quickly launched the Save the Leadmill campaign that's been running ever since, and which, it has to be said, has gained quite a lot of support from artists and music fans and the Sheffield music community. Although, as you've already said, Electro Group would argue that a bunch of that support has come through the misleading idea that the Leadmill is set to close. And obviously, in a world where it's quite common for city centre music venues to be closed down because the landlord wants to turn the property into flats or apartments or whatever, people are always very, you know, nervous and rightly angry when that sort of thing happens. And so basically what Madden is saying or claiming is that the Save Leadmill campaign is basically presenting itself as if it's that kind of campaign rather than a campaign against a change of the programming team at the venue. The deadline for the current team to leave the building came and went earlier this year. That team are continuing to run the venue and to program shows into the venue into 2024. It emerged earlier this month that the Electric Group has now actually begun formal legal proceedings to evict the current operator and his team. That should get to court next year. And I think it will be quite hard for the current team. I mean, whether or not you think it's bad or not bad for the current team to be removed, I think legally they are going to struggle to argue why they should stay because the lease has expired, and I suspect that that's what will be confirmed in court next year. But you mentioned that there's another date coming up, which is why the campaign has been ramped up in the last week, and that is a meeting of Sheffield Council's licensing committee in September, because the Electric Group want to get their own license for running a venue in the building. Obviously, the current management team have a license as well, but they want to get what we call a shadow premises license, which basically means for a period of time there will be two licenses in place for that building, one by the tenant who is running it, one by the landlord. My assumption would be that the reason why Electro Group are doing that is if and when they get to take direct control of the building at some point, maybe in 2024, there wouldn't need to be a gap while a new license is secured, because one license would expire and then this shadow premises license would become an active license for the space. So that application for a license and the meeting that's happening in September has become a bit of a focus for the Save the Leadmill campaign.
Yes, so when the Electric Group began that process, the current team urged their supporters to formally object to the new license application with Sheffield Council. And they noted that without a premises license, a venue cannot operate, saying in a statement, the general public are able to object to a premises license application if they are aware of any relevant reasons as to why it should not be granted. And while it seems likely that some of those supporters definitely did submit objections to the council, the relevant reasons allowed for objecting to a license application are actually quite narrow. So there are four main reasons that would justify any objection, which are the prevention of crime and disorder, public safety, the prevention of public nuisance, and the protection of children from harm. And it's hard to see how a change of management would come under any of those categories. So all of this means that it does seem fairly optimistic to think that the electric group's plans to take control of the lead mill will be blocked by the council's licensing committee. Nevertheless, that meeting of the committee is set for the 18th of September, and the Save the Lead Mill campaign continues.
Yeah, and for the campaigners, that has now become the next key date in the diary, hence why this new video was created and published last week. As you say, it's very emotive. It has rousing music in the background. We won't read out what it says, but Andy will put a link to the video in the show notes for this edition, so you can go and watch that yourself. But I think one interesting line is, it says, the battle we are facing is whether in the years ahead we have more or less independence in Sheffield. And I think the reason why that is interesting is that the Save the Lead Mill campaign are not just saying, oh, the lead mill's going to close, there's not going to be a venue anymore, which obviously isn't true. They are also saying, okay, maybe a venue will continue to be operated by the electric group, but it won't be the lead mill. It won't be run by the Sheffield-based team that have run the venue in the past years. And so that, I think that's why that talk about, you know, the lead mill having independence is a key part of the video that was released last week. That said, Madden at the Electric Group has previously sought to counter the idea that the Electric Group is some massive corporation coming in to run the venue. They do have a network of venues around the UK, but it's a small network of venues. They are actually a relatively small independent live music company. And yes, their first venue was in Brixton in London, but they also have bases elsewhere around the country. And so I think the Electric Group, as well as trying to stress that the venue is not going to disappear entirely, basically it'll just be a different team running a very similar venue to the one that is already there. It may not be called Lead Mill. That will depend on whether or not they can get the legal rights to use the name, but it will continue. Plus, the other thing that he's been trying to say in recent statements, including the statement he issued last week, is we're not a big global corporation. We're a relatively small UK company, and we will be recruiting Sheffield people, probably a lot of the current team, to run the venue.
Yeah, he said, we're good people, and we actually bought the venue to protect it from being redeveloped. Every city has its own peculiar, weird and wonderful handwriting, and the venues need to reflect that. We don't run a chain of venues. We're not the O2 Academy. He also noted, as he has done before, Electric Group acquired the Lead Mill building from MCR Properties with a genuine concern for its future and the possibility of redevelopment. As operators of multiple music venues across the UK, it seemed only natural that we would step in to protect this iconic space. And you might be wondering why the venue needed protecting. He also stated, and this is something he said before, Phil Mills, the current operator of the Lead Mill, had several opportunities to purchase the freehold of the building, including during a public auction in 2014. However, he chose not to pursue this course of action, and as a result, Electric Group acquired the freehold in 2016. Our intention from the beginning has been to continue operating the venue as a music, arts and comedy hub, preserving its legacy.
Yeah, and last week's statement concluded, to reiterate, our intentions have always been rooted in preserving and enriching the cultural fabric of Sheffield. We are excited about the opportunity to continue the Lead Mill's legacy and build upon its rich heritage as a beloved music and arts venue. So that's also quite a rousing statement. If it was set to the same music as the video that the Lead Mill team, the current Lead Mill team, published last week. So an interesting story to follow. Obviously, while Electric Group are excited about getting in there and investing in the space and developing space, that is what they are claiming they will do. There's still some other hurdles to cross. In the meantime, I don't see this being resolved quietly. I think it probably will get to court next year. Meanwhile, we will see what happens at this council meeting in September.
But that's all we've got time for on this edition of Setlist. Do go and check the show notes for more on everything we've discussed this week, including that Save the Leadmill video, if you want to go and watch that. Don't forget to subscribe to the show if you haven't done that already. Rate and review the show if you haven't done that already, or even if you have. And if you've got anything you want to tell us, you can email us setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Malt and Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.